Hello and welcome back to our series on the aftermath of the Council of Nicaea. In the first century, from Pentecost, say 33 to 100 AD, the apostles were still alive for most of that century. The memories of them were strong. The church was growing on a Jewish base, but also making progress in the Gentile world. In the next 150 years, say from 100 to 250, there was sporadic state persecution. There were the seeds of clergy-laity, that division between spectators and participants, although it was fairly innocent at this point. There were problems with breakaway groups and theology, and these, for the most part, were worked through. Now, in the years from 250 to 325, persecution continues. In fact, some of the worst persecution. And then, all of a sudden, because of a man named Constantine, Christianity is now officially tolerated. The church has been growing, gradually displacing the pagan gods. At the same time, the Roman Empire has been weakening. Well, I'm not an historian, just a friend of history. But I'd like today for us to talk about a couple more of the consequences of the Council of Nicaea. So last time we looked at the first, shibboleths and labeling. Today, let's talk about the second, artificial unity, and then also we'll talk about hierarchies and honorific titles. Certainly at Nicaea, the biblical position, that is that Jesus is eternally God, was upheld. And Arius, who promoted a different view, a lesser view, was rightly censored. So I'm not opposed to the council on the in tackling an issue and issuing a position. It was, after all, a very important position, but not one I'm so encouraged by the way dissenters were dealt with. But let's come to that in a moment. When it comes to the unity that was portrayed, that the whole Christian world believes in the Council of Nicaea and follows this, it's really not true, partly because a lot of Christians didn't even know it was happening and wouldn't have understood it even if they had been eavesdropping, but also because the council was quite skewed. Most all of the several hundred leaders who were there were from the Eastern Empire, not the Western Empire. Now, the West would include Italy and Gaul or Spain, Gaul meaning France, Spain, Britain, North Africa. That would be the West where normally Latin was the language of choice. The Eastern Empire would be Asia Minor, what we call today modern Turkey, where Greek was spoken, or in perhaps Greece itself, okay, or Alexandria, the second city of the empire. There were about 1,800 bishops invited, but only 18% came. So it's not like all the leaders came. And now, when they came, their trip was paid for by the Roman government. It covered all their travel expenses. And for some of them, it was weeks and weeks of travel both directions. In fact, some of them died on the way or even died in Nicaea. Artificial unity, what do I mean? Well, it hardly stamped out Arianism. There may have been a consensus, but there were church leaders who actually favored the Arian interpretation who just kind of went along with it. There was a lot of pretense there. And in fact, from this point, it's quite clear that there's bitter rivalry amongst the main leaders in Alexandria, Egypt, in Antioch, Syria, today it's part of Turkey, Constantinople, modern Istanbul. Constantinople was put above Alexandria. Rome wasn't very happy either, because Constantinople, the city that Constantine named after himself, it already existed. It wasn't a city with any biblical connections, not like Jerusalem, right? There's bitter rivalry, and we see this almost immediately. And in the main part of the church, it never really died out. I've got one more comment about unity. Normally, if you take a church history course, you'll hear about the seven ecumenical councils. Now, ecumenical means that they represented Christians everywhere. Everyone was participating. And that's kind of true, but kind of not true. And seven, well, I think that's a little bit selective. What do I mean? Well, of four patriarchates in the East, two rejected one of the councils, the Council of Ephesus. That would be happening in 431 AD. Only two of four accepted it. Not a single person from Rome attended the next council, the Council of Constantinople, 381. Chalcedon, which was right after Ephesus in the 450s, was not universally accepted either. And there were certainly parts of the West that rejected the seventh council altogether. That's the council in 787. And besides, there were other councils traditionally not counted in the seven. What do I mean? Well, the Roman Catholics claim 21 councils. So the seven ecumenical councils actually include three in Constantinople, but the Catholic Church has a fourth Council of Constantinople. The first to fifth councils at the Lateran, which was an ancient church building in Rome. So there are five councils there, two in Lyon, in France, in Vienne, in Constance, in Florence, in Trent, one council in each of those, and then two, what we call First and Second Vatican Councils. The last Vatican Council was in the 1960s. So the Catholics would say, hey, we've got 21 councils. The Orthodox would say, hey, there's seven. But actually, there are even more than 21. And so there's quite this impression that everyone was on board. And if you're part of our group, whether it's Orthodox or Catholic, or perhaps not, perhaps Protestant, then you're on the right side. It inevitably leads to oversimplifying things. Now, I know that I'm sharing a lot of details here, but I will give you a paper with all of my notes. All right, I'll make that available. I'll tell you how to get it as you certainly by the time of the last talk. So, one, shibboleths and labeling. Two, artificial unity. I mean, there was certainly a majority, but it's not like everyone was on the same page here or in the subsequent councils. And three, let's talk about hierarchies and honorific titles. The apostles set up no elaborate leadership structure. Things were very simple. If the apostles of Jesus understood him, and that's reflected in the kinds of church polity that we see in the New Testament, then it was very simple. The elders would lead the church, the deacons, the ministers, servants would interface with the poor. That's pretty much it. Oh, and people would go out as missionaries or evangelists and establish churches where Christ was not known. Now, if he had meant to set up an elaborate structure, let's say like a structure modeled on the diocese of the Roman Empire, a diocese or diocesis is an administrative unit. So there was, for example, a diocese of the East and one of Asia and one of Britain. I mean, all of Britain was in one diocese. I was brought up Episcopalian, my wife Anglican, and so we're very familiar with those terms. Or if you're Catholic, you would be familiar with those terms too. But as you know, in modern church world, we have not just priests, but you've got bishops who will be over multiple cities, and then archbishops, and some bishops are so important that they're cardinal bishops, like the first order bishops, and they select a father, a first among equals, a pope, or in the Orthodox Church, a metropolitan. But it's very complicated, elaborate leadership structure. If that's what Jesus wanted, presumably he would have said something about that. No, I think this simply evolved, and that with Constantine, and with the acceptance and the financial support that he and the empire provided, which extended even to purchasing buildings, constructing buildings for Christians to meet in, paying salaries of priests and so forth. Well, it's not surprising that the church basically mirrored the Roman Empire in the way it was set up. think that hierarchy is going way beyond what is written. The Council of Nicaea came out with a number of canons. Now, these are points of, well, I don't know if you would call them church law at that point. Now they are. Canon law is a huge area of study. I once spent some time with a priest who studied the Vatican. His expertise was in canon law. Canon. If Council of Nicaea, canons 4, 6, and 15 were all about appointments and control. Who appoints whom? You know, how are church leaders appointed? Canon 7 specifies the most important patriarchates and really puts down Antioch, which is a real shame because Antioch is the missionary church in the New Testament. In the time of the apostles, Antioch was an important city and still was, but it was so important in population. You have Rome, then Alexandria, and then Antioch, and probably Ephesus would be number 4. Canon number 18 specifies special seating and special titles for Christian leaders. Now, how do I know this? Because I've read them. I've read the canons. In fact, you can find this online. You can read everything that was generated by the Council of Nicaea. It won't take you much time at all. Eastern Orthodox believers, Ethiopian Orthodox, and Byzantine Catholics to this day speak of Constantine the Great as equal to the apostles. If you go to Istanbul and you see the Church to Holy Wisdom, Hagia Sophia, above one of the entrances, you'll see Constantine with a halo, and he is a saint. He's considered to be a saint. Now, whether he is, I'm not going to comment on that right now, but you talk about hierarchy and honorific titles. Didn't Jesus forbid these? Matthew 23, 8 to 10. Don't call anyone father or teacher. You know, you have one teacher, Jesus says. Don't go after the special seats of honor and so forth. I think Jesus spoke very clearly about this. And yet it's human nature to, well, that's why he spoke clearly about it, because it's human nature to go for honor and personal glory and position and all the jockeying that comes from that. And so we've talked about artificial unity and hierarchies, honorific titles as well. And that's quite sad. Well, I don't want you to think it was all negative, because in the 4th century, as I've said, perhaps 10% of the cities in the empire were aligning themselves with Christianity. By the end of the 4th century, that is by the year 400, 80, sometimes even 90% of the cities were Christian. Out of the country, in the hinterland, the old superstitions took a lot longer to die. So maybe it was only 50% Christian, at least by practice. But in the cities, by the end of the century, vast majority of the Roman Empire was aligning with Christianity. There's something very good about that. Even if it was diluted, there's something good about that. Well, we'll come back next time, and we're going to talk about a couple more. Actually, we're going to cover 3 more consequences, starting with lack of grace. I hope this is helpful to you. Thank you for listening.